Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today is a Karachi-born British novelist of 7 books translated into over 20 languages. She's been longlisted for the Man Booker Prize, shortlisted for the Costa Novel Award, the Orange Prize for Fiction, and the Bailey's Women Prize for Fiction. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and one of Granta's best of young British novelists. Kamila Shamsi, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much.
I can't tell you how wonderful it is to finally have you in the studio. I've been such an admirer of your work for such a long time. But this last book, Home Fire, absolutely blew me away. And as we were just saying before the interview, I think it's a desperately necessary book. It's a book that particularly British people who have no idea what it is to live as a Muslim in this Western society need to read.
When I wrote the book, of course, I had no idea, because you never do, what kind of response it would receive. And I've been struck by 2 very different responses, both of which are very moving to hear. And one is British Muslims who read it and say to me, when we read this book, it spoke to the world as we know it in ways that we rarely see depicted in fiction or anywhere. And the other is people who are British but not Muslim, saying we had no idea. And it's sort of really striking to me, these 2 responses.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd though, isn't it? Because there are a lot of Muslim writers and you'd think that this experience would be documented more often, and it just isn't.
Well, you know what to say about that. I suppose there's a lot to write about.
Anyway, this is not how we normally start Meet the Writers. Normally we start off with your life, really, and your first literary influences. Now, I know that you were born in Karachi in the 70s, which really wasn't a time where women were particularly encouraged to do very much at all. But you come from this long line of incredibly illustrious women who were involved in politics and in literature.
When you grow up, you just think that your family's normal because that's your family. And so it wasn't until much later that I realised how fortunate it was that, even though in Pakistan it was a particularly bleak time, it was military dictatorship under the rule of ضیاء-الحق, and he tried to cut down on anything that was joyous, really, leaving us only cricket in terms of joy. But the sort of cultural sphere, he really attacked it. But within my home, there was a world where books and writing mattered, and my mother would make sure that she always knew what was happening in the free world. She is a writer, a critic. She's now the foremost expert on Pakistani writers in the English language. But when I was growing up, she would order books from England. She would always find out who won the Booker, for instance. And so I grew up in the 80s when I was coming into adolescence, and I was reading Ishiguro and Undachi and Anita Desai and Salman Rushdie and Peter Carey, and that really exciting moment of what was then termed Commonwealth literature. I was fully aware of it. But the other thing that was also happening was, in the way that actions create opposite responses, in Pakistan in the 80s, precisely because there was this deeply misogynist, anti-literary sort of atmosphere at the government level, you had these amazing writers who were writing back to it and writing against it. And in particular, there were feminist poets working in Urdu who were very much part of the anti-military movement. And so there was also within the broader world this notion that writing and politics and resistance all went together. So there was that awareness as well, even though Urdu was not my first language and it was sort of a muted awareness. But it was still very much part of that world that I was growing up in.
English is your first language. Did that set you apart within Pakistan?
Well, not within the Pakistan I was growing up in. It would just say that the school I went to was, the language of instruction was English, and all my friends spoke English, and my parents spoke English, and their friends spoke English. But of course, as happens in many post-colonial societies, there's a class and privilege element to it. So that very much was and is the case.
But of course, you didn't stay in Pakistan. You went off to the States to go to college.
I went to university in America, as did many people who were at the school I was at.
A very famous school, we should point out, with all sorts of people. Benazir Bhutto went there, for instance.
My school in Karachi, yes, Benazir Bhutto went there. It was a school which had a line to universities in England and America. So it wasn't in any way unusual within that school to go and study abroad. And I went to a place in upstate New York. And it was one of the great acts of good fortune in my life was I landed up in this place, which was a tiny, as they call it there, liberal arts college of 1,600 students in the snow belt in upstate New York, 5 hours from everywhere. It was a 5-hour drive from Boston, from New York City, from Montreal, right? And in this extraordinary isolated place, there was a poet from Kashmir, a man called Agha Shahid Ali, who became my first teacher of writing and mentor and friend and was this amazing influence. And it just, when you look back and you think there, you know, I went all the way from Karachi to the middle of nowhere, upstate New York snow belt, to find a poet from Kashmir.
And of course, you'd been writing though since you were a child.
Books were always the great love of my life. And when I was very, very young, I had no idea that you could grow up to be a reader. Later, I discovered there were ways to do this. And so when people would say, as they do to children, and what are you going to be when you grow up? To me, the next best thing after reading was writing. So I said, I'm going to be a writer. And then when I was 11, my best friend came over, and he and I, among the many things we had in common, we had two things particularly in common. One was our love of books. We would always share novels with each other. And the other was that we both had pet dogs that had recently died and had been, for both of us, the first great loss of our lives. And we used to talk a lot about these pet dogs. I had peculiarly found in my grandfather's bookshelf, I still don't know how it got there, a novel called All Dogs Go to Heaven, unrelated from the later Disney cartoon of the same name. And I read it and wept copiously and then said to my best friend when he came over, you must read this book. And he said, and to this day, I have no idea, and neither does he, what made him say this. He said, we should write a book. And so he and I started writing a book together about dog heaven. We were 11 years old and really haven't stopped writing since.
Do you still have that book?
I still do. And last year when I was in Karachi, my sister now teaches at the school we were at, and I went to speak to the 11-year-olds because they were having book week. My sister fished out the manuscript and said, you should read out a bit of this to them. And so I took along and read it to the... And I looked at them and they were 11 and they're tiny. And I thought, God, I was... To have that certainty at that age, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm starting today.
Well, and given the body, your body of work, I'm quite sure you get that manuscript published.
Well, I don't think it's worth that.
But of course, it continued. And again, you scored a first because your first novel was published while you were still at college, written while you were at college, published when you were 25.
Yeah, so I went from Hamilton, I went, because the Kashmiri poet I spoke about, Agha Shahid Ali, then while I was still at Hamilton, he moved to the University of Massachusetts at Amherst to teach in the MFA program in creative writing. And he said, oh, you should apply here. And so I applied, then I got in. And I was there in Massachusetts working on a novel. And then it got accepted while I was still a student. So, it was, yeah.
So this is In the City by the Sea, which is about Karachi. Did you have to leave in order to write about your home?
I did. It was sort of very odd because when I was in Karachi, I wasn't that much interested in writing the world around me. And then as soon as I left, and I missed it tremendously, and writing about it became a way of being there. And so, of course, which meant that when I was writing at 18 or 19, it was a very sort of nostalgic form of writing, a lot of it. But it then meant that when I would go back to Karachi for the summers and winters, I would look at it differently. Mm. And I would look at it as a place that I could gather information about. Mm.
It's so interesting that you're talking about your very, very first book being 11, because, of course, the protagonist in this is an 11-year-old boy.
There's a wonderful book called The Conversations, which is Michael Ondaatje in conversation with Walter Murch, the film editor. And there's something in there that Murch said which really struck me when I read it. He said, I think the people who have the greatest chance of being content in their lives are those who, as adults, are doing some version of the thing they loved when they were around 11 or 12. And he said, it's such a particular age because you're old enough to really start having a sense of self and who you are and what you want. And you're just young enough that you're not being consumed by peer pressure. Mm. And so there's something at that age. And I really feel it, that there's something about that age, that there's some part of you, or certainly some part of me. Mm. It's also that interesting cusp of childhood, adolescence, where you're moving, you know, between being very young and sort of grown up. Mm. So 11 has always been an interesting age in my life.
And it's very much a storytelling book. Your hero's trying to find plots, isn't he, to save his uncle.
It is. It's about a boy who is in a world that can't be understood. It makes no sense because it's so horrific. And the place he goes for refuge, really, which then becomes a way of understanding the world, is books.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. And Shakespeare, Arthurian legend.
Yeah, all the things I loved, really, when I was that age.
Now, you won a big award for that. I think it was the Prime Minister's Award for Literature.
Mm, that was a funny one because it was announced on TV on the news channel in Karachi that I had won this. And that was, I think, the 10th of October, 1999. And the next day or 2 days later, the Prime Minister was ousted in a military coup. And there was this moment when my publishers here, Bloomsbury, were going to make a big noise to the press about me having won the Prime Minister's Award. And I'd say, just hold on because there's a dictator in town. And you never know that any association of any kind with the Prime Minister might be a bad thing. And then no one knew whether this Prime Minister's Award would actually be awarded since there was no longer a Prime Minister. And it came with a rather nice cheque. And one day the cheque just appeared. And then a little later, a letter appeared and it was signed the day of the coup. So clearly it was one of the last things the Prime Minister did in office was to sign this letter, which is a beautiful letter. You know, I don't think he wrote it, about how writers, you know, give voice and utterance to our times and our worries. And there it is signed.
How
this
fantastic.
Historic document.
Almost couldn't have been.
I know.
You came out with another two books before you were 30.
It's sort of odd now to look back on. Yeah. You just realize there's something about the energy of those early days of writing. And, you know, later on in life, I like to think you learn other things as a writer. And technically you gain a lot, but you that there's a particular kind of energy when it's just all bursting to come out. And I think those first three or four novels, you know, I hadn't finished one before I was starting the next.
And do you look back and think, oh, this is quite immature and actually I would have done it differently now?
I think, oh, this is really immature or, God, I you know was really overwriting or I would never do that now. But I also know that I had to write those books to write the next books. You know, I mean, I see all the novels very much as stepping stones to the next thing. So even though there's a bit of me that opens a page and says, God, why did I just take three pages to do that? I have an enormous affection for them. And I do recognise things in there that I just wouldn't know how to do now almost. It's sort of you've gone so far in one direction that you look back at the early things and think, actually, I don't know how to sit and linger in the way I used to.
Mm. It's interesting that you talk about them as stepping stones because actually they are that in time and location. It's almost you've got a timeline. Can you take us through it?
One of my closest friends said to me some years ago something about how the novels had written their way through different periods of Pakistan's history. And I looked and I said, I suppose you're right, I hadn't thought of it. And she was really gobsmacked. And she said, you're not telling me it wasn't intentional. I said, it really wasn't intentional. But the first one, In the City by the Sea, although the place isn't named and the dictator isn't named, but it very much is drawing on being young in Pakistan in the 80s. During the years of General Zia's rule. And then the next one, Salt and Saffron, is in the 90s, although there's a backstory of 1947. But really, it's sort of Karachi in the early 90s, I suppose. And then Cartography is very much a period in the mid-90s when Karachi was in a terrible state of civil strife and the violence there was just horrific. But there's also a backstory of 1971. So I think at a very early stage, there was a thing that I wasn't comfortable or didn't just want to locate something in one place. Mm-hmm. So if it was in one place, there would be two time periods. And then Broken Verses is sort of the beginning of the war on terror years, but what they look like from Pakistan, so around 2003. And then came Burnt Shadows, which was originally going to be another novel set primarily in Karachi and then somehow ended up being a novel that starts in Nagasaki in 1945, then goes to Delhi in 47, then Pakistan, Afghanistan, 1982, 83, and then New York and Afghanistan in 2002. So suddenly it became a different kind of writing project.
Talk about these things kind of happening to you as if you have no control.
No, I mean, I don't want to be one of those writers who says, you know, then I sat there and it all descended upon me. Of course, I have control, but with a lot of the books, I start out with very little certainty. There are a few images or ideas or something that I'm interested in, and I want to follow where they're going. And what happens in the process of writing a novel is I work out the things that I'm interested in, that I've been thinking about, that have been at the back of my head, that I've been trying to understand or wanting to understand. And the novel sort of gives shape and direction to them. Mm. So, of course, it's not that I'm just sitting there waiting for the muse to descend.
Is there an element of that at all?
Not for the muse, because the muse to descend is sort of something external coming to you. Whereas I think of writing much more as a movement from the surface to the internal. So it's finding a way to bits of your brain and your heart and your soul that have been working away, but you needed the idea of the novel to give you the path to them, I suppose. Mm.
Where were you when these books were coming together? Because you moved around a lot.
Well, the first one was written, a lot was written in Massachusetts, but I was, even when I was at university in America, I would go home to Karachi every summer and winter. So 5 months of the year would be in Karachi and 7 months in America. And I would be writing in Karachi as well. So that first novel got written equally. The three after it, Salt and Saffron Cartography, Broken Verses, were written primarily in Karachi, because even though I would move around, I had occasional teaching positions in America. I would come to London for bits when a book was being written. But Karachi was the place I was based in, and it was my writing place. Mm. And it was with Burnt Shadows that I moved. And partly I was able to move because I was writing a novel for the first time that wasn't located in Karachi. I always used to think, if I'm going to write about the city, I should be living here, because it's such a fast-paced, changing city. I didn't want to be one of those people who's writing about a place but no longer has that connection to it. Mm. And then I started to write Burnt Shadows, and I realised there are different ways of writing. And one is the kind of writing I'd been doing was always about writing the familiar and the intimate. So not only was I writing about Karachi, I was writing about sort of 2 square miles of Karachi around which I lived. And with Burnt Shadows, I learnt the pleasure and also the frustration about using the writing as a way to inhabit new places or to learn new places.
Sort of racker or,
yeah. And I realised there doesn't have to be a literal connection between my location and the location of the novel. And I think that understanding was partly what allowed me to leave Karachi and move to London, that the novels can happen in places where I'm not.
Of course, moving to London, though, isn't quite as easy as it sounds, because there's the whole visa process.
Now it's almost impossible. A writer who was at the position in my life and career that I was in then simply would not be able to come to London today to live, to the UK. There's no visa possibility. There's no route. You can't do it. They don't want you. I was lucky. I came in just about the last point that was possible, because there used to be a thing called the Writers, Artists and Composers Visa. And I came in on it really in the last year of its existence, and then found a couple of years in that they'd got rid of it and I had to move to another visa category. And if I couldn't do that, I'd have to leave. And because I had just sold a novel, Burnt Shadows, and I'd sold it in several countries, so there was this few months in which a fair amount of money came in, which made it look like I was a high earner, even though, of course, if you're a writer, you're spreading that out over several years. And that allowed me to cross a certain income threshold. That income threshold within 2 years doubled or tripled, so it would no longer have been possible for me to do it. And then they got rid of that visa category as well. So, I mean, I got in at the last possible opportunity. And it is a really sad thing now to think that a country that once had a visa specifically for writers, artists and composers and recognised these are the kind of people we want. If you look at the rules, which very few people do, if you actually look at the rules for migration now, it might as well just say, if you make a lot of money, you can come in, otherwise don't bother.
Yeah. And also, I mean, at a particularly febrile time, I mean, what year are we talking about here?
I moved here in 2007.
So, of course, I mean, you're watching the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, making all these decisions, really, that would affect your future.
When I came in, it was still a Labour government, and they were the ones, it should be said, much it pains me to say it, who got rid of the writers, artists and composers visa. But then once Conservative government came in, it got even more and more difficult. Mm. And Theresa May was Home Secretary when I became a British citizen, and I was watching the things she was saying and doing. And it was very clear, if you're watching, that she just didn't see the point of most of us, unless we were making a lot of money.
And of course, there's still the thing that if you have a visa, if you now have right to remain, as I do, I'm not born British, I'm also on a similar kind of passport, where if you've done something, they can take it away from you.
Well, if you're a dual national, they can take it away from you, which I am. I'm a dual national. And partly one of the things I was interested in writing Home Fire about was because I was interested in and terrified by the ways in which Theresa May wanted to expand the ability to take away, not even just right to remain for those who have that, but wanted to increase the powers to strip people of their British citizenship.
Let's talk about Home Fire now. It's such a wonderful book, and it seems to me it's a book that could only have really been written once you got here to Britain. The soul of it is so very British. So one of the lines for me that really sticks in my head is Googling whilst Muslim. And the book starts, I suppose we should say that it's based on Antigone. And the book starts in an airport. I just want you just to talk us through that part.
Right. Well, we should say the book is based on Antigone. And if you haven't read Antigone, please don't rush out and read it, because there's no need to know Antigone.
And it's quite complicated, Antigone, actually. It gets into quite a kind
Well, I mean, one of the things I did want to do was make it work for people who didn't know Antigone, but also make it work for those who did know Antigone. I didn't want them to think, oh, well, I know what's going to happen on every page because I read Antigone.
And in fact, you don't, because it ends in a different
way. Yeah. So, I mean, but it starts with a young woman. She doesn't feel young. But she is. She's about 27. I mean, she doesn't think of herself as young because the world has not been easy on her. And she's going to America to study, to get her PhD. It's finally sort of an escape from the responsibility of bringing up her younger siblings, which is what she's been doing since the age of 21. She's a British citizen. She's lived in London her whole life. No other home. And she's trying to leave to go to university. And she's hauled into an interrogation room. And made to answer many questions, which start with, do you consider yourself British? And she says, I am British. And the man says, but do you consider yourself British? And there it goes from there.
Yeah, I mean, it's so beautifully done, because she's rehearsed all these answers. I mean, but things like sort of political questions, but also who won British Bake Off?
and you know, someone said that was sort of a bit silly, but all right, you're allowed artistic license. But actually the reason I put that in was I was reading about British Muslims who had been stopped at airports in Britain and asked questions. And one of them reported that among the questions he was asked was, do you watch Dad's Army? This was a few years ago. And he said no. And he said clearly this counted against him that he didn't watch Dad's Army.
But I mean, this is a very real thing. Is this something that you, I suppose perhaps not so much now with your British citizenship, your passport, but are you still getting this when you go in and out of airports?
No, but there were several years when every time I'd go into America, I would be pulled into the secondary interrogation room. And nothing terrible ever happened, I should say. What does happen is, of course, who had that line? My life was full of disasters, it never happened.
Yeah.
So if you were a Muslim in the world post 9/11, you really understand this, because every time I would be pulled into the interrogation room and, you know, you'd have to sit and wait for them to call your number, and you would, in your head, I was running through all these possibilities, such as, what do I do if they ask me what I think of George Bush? What do I do if they ask me what I think of the war in Iraq? You know, and all these things. And so I never had an interrogation like this, but I imagined it over and over. And I had so many friends who had all kinds of hideous interrogations.
Yeah.
You know.
In the book, the boy, the brother, is recruited. He joins IS and wants to go off and wage jihad. And you are really interesting on what that means. And I've heard you talk about it when you say that jihadism is less about violence and religion than about deficient masculinity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think he wants to go and wage jihad at all. He's not interested in being a fighter. And I think that was one of the things that was interesting to me in and terrifying about Islamic State, was that unlike other terrorist organizations, they weren't just recruiting fighters. They actually wanted to build a state. Mm. And so they wanted doctors, they wanted engineers, they wanted people who could work in the media unit, they wanted teachers. And so their propaganda was incredibly slick and multi-pronged and appealing to people of all descriptions by trying to create this image of a utopian state. But one of the things that I think really, I mean, I didn't look at any of the gory, horrific images, but they were also putting on lots of beautiful, pleasant, look how lovely we are images. And there's one video on the Muslim holy day of Eid to sort of send out Eid greetings. And it's a quite short video, but what you see in it are these really beautiful young men. I mean, so good looking, all really handsome, all smiling and happy. And they're all hanging out together and they're riding on horses. And you could see how it would appeal not just to young women who would say, oh, you know, that's a really nice looking fella, but it would appeal to young men and not necessarily, I mean, possibly in a homoerotic way, but not necessarily, but also in a way of, that's what I want to be. Mm. Here are these confident, happy brothers together on horses and being treated with respect and all, I mean, and so part of what was so terrifying, I think, in the propaganda was the way in which it appealed to young men who had issues of masculinity, who've been told by the world that the phrase be a man is a really important phrase. Mm. And it is, you know, as women, we don't hear be a woman in that way. But I was talking to a friend of mine who is an American in his 40s. He's a good feminist. He would identify him as such. But I was talking to him about this and he said, it's interesting, but when you use the phrase be a man, he said, I felt my entire body respond. He said, you know, and that phrase has a weight in my life.
It's visceral.
Yeah. He said, and even though I like to think that I interpret be a man in a very different way and that it's not about machismo, he said, but you're right, for any man, it has a weight, be a man. Mm. And I think as long as be a man has a weight, there are going to be people who know how exactly to manipulate it.
Mm. Yeah. Another main protagonist in the book is the son of the Home Secretary, the British Home Secretary, who is Muslim. Mm. Such an interesting character. I found myself envisaging the Mayor of London. Did he have a place in your mind while you were writing that at all?
You know, when I started the book, it was before he was running for Mayor of London. But what I did know when I started the book was that we had, at that point, three British Muslim figures in politics who were quite in the public eye. There was Sadiq Khan in Labour, and there was Sajid Javid and Syed Avarsi in the Conservative Party. I thought, well, this is interesting. And what was also interesting is that they're Muslims in very different ways. Sadiq Khan is not in any way a basis for my Karamat Loan, because Karamat Loan feels that the way to succeed in politics in Britain is to step aside from your Muslimness. You know, so Sadiq Khan, who is observing his fast during Ramadan, but also going out and opening gay pride parade on the same day, the way he's able to, I think, magnificently bring those things together, Karamat Loan doesn't. But of course, the question with Sadiq Khan is always, would that work outside London? Hmm. And Karamat Loan is very clear, he wants to be at the national level. He wants to be PM.
Yeah.
You know, he
yeah.
wants to appeal, have an appeal that is going to cut all across Britain. I mean, it's not entirely cynical. You know, I'm not, and I didn't want him to come across as entirely cynical. It's also, he is an atheist. He has moved away from it. But it's also very politically convenient for him to be the ex-Muslim Muslim.
The book, obviously, I'm not going to reveal how it ends, but it's very, very emotionally powerful. And I wonder how much that affects you as the writer, if I, as the reader, am still in bits 3 weeks after reading it.
There are two novels of mine, this one and Burnt Shadows, which I tricked myself into writing the ending, which is to say, I made myself believe that the endings were not the ending, that something else was going to happen later and everything would be fine. And really, that's the only way I'm able to write it, is by tricking myself. And then you get to that end and you realise, no, this is it. There's no other way to go. There's no way to go from here. This has to be the point at which it ends. It's awful to do unpleasant things to your characters who you've been living with and you've been seeing through their eyes. It's not a fun feeling. But at the same time, as a writer, there's something very, very deeply satisfying about coming to an ending and thinking, yes, this is the only possible ending. Mm.
which is probably where we should end it, but I just want to ask you a couple of things about non-novel related stuff. Index on censorship, also refugees, refugee tales. Now that's where writers and refugees are paired together.
It's an extraordinary project. Britain, to its shame, is the only country in Europe where refugees can be detained for an indefinite period of time. And the majority of those who are detained are then, I mean, the government's line is, oh, we sort of hold them for a little bit to process before they're deported. But actually the majority of those who are held are not deported, then at some point released back. And you think, what was that all about? It's really horrific and inhuman what it does to people's lives. And the fact that these are people who, in many cases, have escaped from horror. And this is supposed to be safety. And so what Refugee Tales does is it takes someone who's come here as a refugee, as an asylum seeker. In many cases, it's people who, most cases, people who've gone through some period of detention. And it pairs them up with a writer. And the idea is they have the stories, but we have that technical ability to shape them in words and sentences and put them out into the world.
And that's so important, as is this book, Home Fire, because that's the way that we understand what's going on.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it's, you know, it was very moving for me to do Refugee Tales. It's a great project. I mean, it's, you know, goes on every year. They have different writers and they also do walks. And the walks are amazing because it's partly people who've been refugees, who've been detained, who are now getting to walk across Britain with this freedom that we all take for granted. In part, it's people who are interested. In part, it's people who've been going as visitors to the detention centres. And they do these walks, and at the end of every day, one of the writers comes in and reads the piece they've written about refugees. In these times, I think it's no good being optimistic, because optimistic is just a way of saying, oh, it'll all turn out fine. But I think we really need to find hope and find those places and those ways of thinking and those people who are doing things against the darkness.
And do you feel it's your responsibility?
No. Writing never feels to me like a responsibility, because, again, responsibility feels, it's almost like I'm doing it because I think it's worthy. The writing has to come from a very deep internal place, and I think what happens is the more you start to see the world in a particular way, the more that's going to come out in the writing. But having said that, there are always days I sit down and think, wouldn't it be lovely if the next thing I wrote could just be a light-hearted murder mystery? Wouldn't that be fun? But I suspect it's not going to happen.
I'm not holding my breath. Kavna, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
Homefire and all of your back catalogue available now. Homefire is published by Bloomsbury Circus. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Stephanie Sykea, Christy Evans and Cassie Gelpin. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.